session number 9483, reel 2.
Mr. Templar, reel 2. Mr. Templar, at the end of the last reel, you were telling us of this man being submitted to number one field punishment. What happened after that?
Well, the field punishment consisted of being tied to the wheel of a limber for a certain period every day. And it was, the limber was in the within the iron railing compound of the guard tent and the Provost Marshal's tent. And he was daily taken out. The weather was very hot. He was a member of C Company, as I said, popular, and all his pals got round the guard compound and yelled for him to be taken out of the untied, so they could have him back again, so to speak. And the Provost Sergeant and the commander of the sergeant of the guard refused to release him, as they had no power to do that, and they threatened therefore that they would pull the rails up and take him out unless they did. An officer arrived and tried to speak to them, but they wouldn't take any notice of him, and as nothing was happening, they just got all round the compound, a lot of them, and they got hold of the iron railings, which were just stuck into the ground, and lifted them out of the ground and went in and released him, and they marched around the camp yelling and shouting. And as I was quite new to these experiences, I just kept on the outskirts. And then somebody, the rumour went round that some of the Warwickshire regiments who were nearby battalions were being sent along to put the riot down, put them down. And there was a shout, and they went back to their tents, got their rifles and bayonets, and charged off up out of the camp and said, "Warwicks, we'll show them." But the Warwicks didn't arrive, and they eventually got tired, and we all went rolled up in our blankets and went to sleep. After that, I don't know what happened. But we were eventually inspected by David Lloyd George, who was Prime Minister and a friend of our Honorary Colonel, and then quietly shifted up to the North Yorkshire on a moor somewhere up in Wensleydale, where we were given spades and tents and told to bloody well dig our own, build our own camp. And digging through heather roots with blunt spades was no light job. In fact, very hard work. But we got on with the job after that, and it settled, the battalion settled down.
What did you think of life in the army?
Oh, I rather enjoyed it. As a matter of fact, just after we got up to North Yorkshire, I had a letter from John, my clubmate, who wrote to me and said, "Look, Charles, I am old enough to be allowed to enlist now." And he said, I wondered if there was a chance that I might enlist in your battalion so that I could be with you in them." And as I was only a private at that point, and a very recent one, I decided I couldn't do much about it except to show the letter to the signals officer. And I did so, and he read it carefully, and he said, "What's this young man like?" I said, "Well, he's a clubmate of mine and a personal friend." I said, "He's a little bit younger than me. He's fairly active and plays tennis." "Oh." He said, "I'll have a word with the adjutant." And so he said, "Probably he'll send for you." So he gave me the letter back, and eventually I was sent for by the adjutant, and I was taken to him by the orderly who come to tell me to go there. And when I was brought it before him, he said, "I understand you have a letter you'd like to show me." I said, "Yes, sir," and handed it to him, and he read it. And he said, "What's he like?" I said, well, he's a little bit younger than me, sir. He's a clubmate of mine, and he plays tennis. And we are friends. So he said, right, I'll give you a railway warrant, which you can send to your friend. It will enable him to travel up here without cost. And when he arrives, I will arrange for him to be examined by the MO, and if he is passed fit for service, we will swear him in the order room here and post him into A Company, and he can camp with you, and eventually, after preliminary training, post to the signals section. So that's how it happened.
What were relations like between enlisted men and the officers?
About just one of normal officer and rankers relationship. They were not bad at all. I think that we probably were a little bit better off than the normal, because we'd been, our lives had been different to these other people's. And one or two of them got the idea that we were only going to get there until we got a commission. But the point was that I couldn't afford a commission anyway, or afford to be an officer, and I was there for keeps, and so was John. So, but it obviously that it made a, created a certain situation, and whenever leave was granted to us while we was either in England or later in France, the order room clerks always arranged for leave passes to be issued to John and I together, so that we went all home at the same time together. So that was the fundamental difference. It was, we had a little bit of privilege in that respect. You see?
Was there any resentment of that from your
No,
colleagues?
Not a bit. Nobody said anything. Nobody minded, and I really got on very well with all these men, because they, even while I was on the preliminary training, we were sent up various little hills around Malvern Link. One was called Caesar's Camp, and we used to have to go up there in full marching order and charge and play about, and then they'd say, you know, get in little groups, and so often the other men from my tent and section would say, well, what the hell are we ought to do now? What do you think we ought to do, Charlie boy? See? And I'd have a look round. Well, I think the right thing is to do this. And they damn well do it. See? In fact, I had my first experience of having a little bit of power, if you like, or without the rank. But that was what happened.
How did you react to discipline in the army?
What?
How did you react to discipline?
Oh, it didn't worry me at all. I thought the army was better for it. And you were trained so that you knew that you got to do what was necessary, whatever circumstances that we were in. And another thing, the marching that we used to do in those days, because there was no auxiliary transport for troops, they had to march everywhere. We used to sing, and it welded a battalion into a unit, and that was very important. Everybody got to know everybody else. Although we were the signalers, we were attached to headquarters in action, but we were still part of the unit.
And can we talk a bit about the training, in fact? Can we talk a bit about training? What's
Oh, you had physical jerks, you know. We had physical jerks and a lot of exercising, shooting, bayonet practice. I think it was there was very little idea of personal combat in those days. Now, nowadays, the army is trained more on personal combat than anything else. And probably their drill, but in those days it was just charging with a fixed bayonet and stabbing a sack full of hay or something of the sort.
What about shooting?
And we did a bit of shooting as well. But I had a very good eye. I was virtually I was capable of being a sniper actually at that time. But I was a signal instead. Much better than being a sniper.
What about trench digging, that sort of thing you trained in?
Well, if it was necessary and you were on your own, you had to dig a trench. So that it was this is a matter of, we had an entrenching tool at that time, which fitted across the backside.
Can you describe that to me?
What?
Can you describe that to me?
Well, it was rather like an adze. It had a spade end and a pick end. And in the centre was the hole where the helve dropped in. It was tapered, and the helve itself had an iron band round it, shaped. It was an oval. And that dropped into, and you could use it as an adze or as a pick. Anyway, it was they called it an entrenching tool. And that was part of our equipment, and worn across the backside, just below your main pack.
What about gas drill? Were you trained in?
Well, no, we had no gas drill before we went to France. But when we landed in France, eventually we were issued with gas helmets, which fitted right over the head, made of flannel or something like that, and impregnated with a pair of goggles and a mouthpiece, which had a rubber valve on the end so that you could blow out, but you didn't draw in air that way. See? Air could be drawn in through the flannelette of the gas headpiece. Very crude.
You were a signaller. What sort of special training did you receive?
We received, taught the Morse code, flag drill mostly for teaching that. You know, flag waving.
Okay.
What? Yeah. Well, we were trained to use buzzers, which could be transmitted. You called Akbar, C, Don, you know, all that sort of thing. Da 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 da. Our call sign as the glossers was da 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 da. GLM. Gloucester's MM was the 13th letter in the alphabet, and that was our call sign on buzzers. And we were called up if we were wanted by da 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 da, and that came our call sign. We answered that and responded, and we got the whatever sign, whether it was division, they had a call sign too. And they came over the air, not over the telephone wire, because there was no radio at all in those days.
How were you trained in the use of Morse code?
Well, with buzzers. We learnt it with flags, we learnt it by listening to buzzers, and we practised amongst ourselves. You know, A was dot dash, B was dash, three dots, dash dot was C, D was dash dot dot. I could give him all to if you wanted it, but I don't want to know.
Can you tell me something about the equipment that you used as a signaller?
We had what they called, I think it was D-Mark III field telephones. And at the originally, during the first part of the war and later, we tried using it with... We used to have to run twin lines. The early issue, I think, was I don't know where they were made, but we had lines with copper wires running through them, and they were very easily broken, and therefore you had no connection. But later we had I forget the number now, but it was a steel, rubber covered steel wire. Insulated steel wire with a copper wire running right through the core. It was the copper that gave you the transmission virtually, because there was less resistance in that to the resistance of steel. and therefore it became a standard.
Do you remember when that was introduced?
Oh, it came fairly late about 1916, I think.
We've spoken about Morse code and we've spoken about the telephones. Were you trained in other methods of communication?
Oh yes, we could have signal lamps. That was simply worked by the same principle, was that you had a key which you operated the lamp with. Every time you pressed the key, of course you pressed it for a dot or a dash. And the people at the other end had a lamp and they could give you an acknowledgement by just a flash of their light, you see. But you signalled, you lined your lamp up on a certain spot, maybe a mile away or half a mile away, whatever it may be. And you pressed out the Morse code, dots and dashes, and told them what you wanted. If it was CI, which means come in, that meant that they'd finished their duty.
Was the training adequate? I mean, did you feel that you were a competent signaller by the time you'd completed your training?
Oh, yes. I know. Well, I was a signal sergeant and the rest of it in the army. And, of course, when the question of the Home Guard eventually came, I was immediately made a sergeant there. I didn't want a commission.
So the training that you received was relevant and adequate?
Yeah, in that section.
Did you receive any other training outside the usual run-of-the-mill?
I don't know that I did. I'm not sure about that. But a lot of things you pick up when you're in the army that you don't need to be told about. Some of them good and some of them not so good.
By the time the training period was completed, did your unit have a clear feeling of its own identity?
Oh, yes. They were the 13th Battalion Gloucesters and they were very proud of it. Oh, yes, and the very fact of the marching we did in those days, because there was no other transport, I think was an extraordinarily good means of welding the battalion into a unit, because men got to know each other through being on the march. They fell out, they talked to each other when we were falling out, because we always marched in France, at any rate. I don't remember much about England in the marching, but in France we always marched for 50 minutes and had a 10-minute halt. In fact, on one occasion when we were marching down from the north part of the line down to the area of the Somme, and later, I forget now, sometime, we were passing through villages where there were a lot of Portuguese soldiers who were the flower of the Portuguese army, and they were put on mending roads, well away from fighting, and all they could do was to bow and scrape to the ladies of the village and throw them kisses and that sort of thing. And they had very gaudy little hats with feathers on them, and as we were marching past, the boys were blowing them raspberries and calling them bloody dagos. So at the halt, which came when the whistles were blown at the end of 50 minutes marching, word was passed down the line from the colonel on one occasion that at the next time the whistles go for a halt, the battalion will come to a halt in close formation as the colonel has something that he wants to say. So I was being in the signal section, we were right up as leaders of the battalion, you see, because the signal sergeant was always the one that led in that position. And the signal section was behind, the officers were either masters at ease and behind the troops, you see. And so the battalion closed up when the whistles went. The colonel sat on his horse and he said, "Look here, you men, you mustn't call these people bloody dagos. They're our gallant allies." And the whole battalion roared with laughter and fell out for their rest.
To return to your period of training while you were still in England, can you tell me something about what recreations you had? Did you associate with local civilians?
Not very much. I was in my 20th year then, you see. I was 19, 1914 I was 20, and 1915 I had yet to become 21. That would happen about July in the following my enlistment. But we, no, there was a certain companionship with your various mates around, you know. And there were always little loyalties in the army, you know. You looked after each other to a certain extent. I remember being persuaded to have the gloves on with somebody, and I made his nose bleed, and I felt very upset. And that sort of thing, but they took it all in good part.
So what did you do in the periods of time that you were off duty?
Oh, well, there wasn't much to do. I forget, really. That's something part of it. We could sit around, we'd talk, we'd go down to the canteen or something of the sort. You know. I don't think there was a question about what you did. And where we were, I suppose some of the men went to the villages or something of the sort, but we were fairly isolated. And especially when we got up into Yorkshire, the only thing that happened up there was we had ladies who came from somewhere in the Yorkshire area to see the troops in their camp, I suppose, with the idea of giving them comfort. But I didn't look forward to that.
You didn't take advantage of the...
No, not in that respect. I had other ideas.
Following your enlistment, you first were posted at Malvern, and subsequently the regiment moved to Yorkshire.
Yeah, when did
what other postings did you have? What other postings did you have?
Postings?
Prior to being sent to France.
We returned from Yorkshire some couple or 3 months after being up there.
What month would that be?
Can't remember at all, but I should think... I forget whether it was... We returned in July or something like that. I'm not sure now. But we returned and we'd been trained up in the Wensleydale area, and the train came through as the unit was embarked on this train and finished up in Winchester. And I remember we were detrained on Winchester station, and the band was ordered to go to the head of the column to play us through Winchester, and it was midnight. And we marched through Winchester with the band going at full blast. And it wasn't Colonel Bogey they played. I forget what it was they played, but the boys enjoyed the march because with the noise of the band and the marching feet, the windows of the inhabitants of Winchester were being thrown up on the route, and people were looking out of their bedroom windows with their nightcaps on, and the boys were cheering them, and you know, and it was quite a joke, but it was a fairly sharp march, and I think we got to a place called Hursley Camp, Hursley Down, and we encamped there, and later we went on to Aldershot.
What were conditions like at Winchester, at Hursley Down?
Oh, not bad. I forget what we were in, whether we were in... I really forget, but we had some huts. I think for a time there, while we were there, I was sent on detachment to take charge of a signal point away from the main body, and for some purpose, I forget what it was now, but we had our rations dished out to us, and we had to do our own cooking and everything else, which we did on primitive sort of braziers.
Do you have any recollection of what your duties were?
Only on the telephones, in contact with presumably one of the brigade headquarters or division. I forget now. You know, we moved on to Aldershot. And we were only there a short time, but during that, while we were there, I think we were in huts there, but I don't remember. There was a Zeppelin came over and we saw it being attacked by an aeroplane. I have an idea it was brought down in flames, but not very clear now. And after that, we moved on to a camp in Whitley. You see, and at Whitley, the We spent several weeks there. It was an encampment in huts, with the sort of Nissen type of huts.
Do you remember what time of year this was?
Oh yes, it was in the latter end of the year, because we were there, I should think, 2 months, or probably 3 months, I'm not sure now. But while we were there, John had an invitation from... he'd written to his employers, the Methuens. He worked for Methuens, the printers, the publishers. And Sir Algernon Methuen and Lady Methuen lived at Hazelmere, not far from where we were. And John received an invitation to take me as his friend and go and take tea with the Sir Algernon and Lady Methuen. And I felt very clumsy in my army boots. And we were waited on by a very prim little housemaid and given a very, very nice tea. And the housemaid had a pretty little apron with lace cap and everything else. I felt extraordinarily clumsy. But later, after John had died, I came across a letter from them.
Did you have any leave during this period?
Yes. After enlisting and being posted to Malvern, I had my first home leave from there and was given a railway pass to come up to London. And it was rather nice, because it was before John had joined up. And so I went up to see him, and especially his sister, you see. But I had quite a nice leave. I remember spending some time with my uncles, and we had a little party. But I was back again. It was only a short leave, about 7 days. And then later, of course, we had leaves from Yorkshire. We also had leaves from Whitley. Whilst at Whitley, I was made a Lance Corporal. And being made an NCO, I was immediately available for guard duty. Signalers as specialists were absolved from guard duty, but the NCOs, signal NCOs, were not, and were liable to guard duty. So I was immediately warned for guard duty on the Saturday night, to mount guard as Lance Corporal of the Guard on Saturday afternoon. Unfortunately, John's mother, father, and two sisters, Daisy and Prim, were coming down to see him at Whitley Camp and returning on an afternoon train back to London. But as I had to mount guard at 6 o'clock on the Saturday evening, I would be on duty for 24 hours and probably not have an opportunity.